You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM. Welcome back to the Batuta Advocate radio show. You're joined by myself, Clancy Overall, and Errol Parker, editor at large. There's been a lot going on in the news, a lot less than there was earlier in the year. But yeah, we're dealing with a whole lot of things right now. Cost of living, lettuce prices have gone through the roof. Didn't see that one coming. Energy crisis, inflation. There's been a minimum wage hike. There's a lot going on. And in times like this, in, you know, uncertain times, chaos, be that political or socioeconomic or global instability, we often turn to one thing, at least in Batuta we do, and that is rock and roll music. It's been there with us over the years through thick and thin. And today's guest is, I guess, a pioneer of Australian rock music, and he's been there with us through thick and thin. He's been on our TV screens. He's been on our radios. He's been at our house parties. He's been everywhere. It's a real honour to have him in here today to talk to us about what he's been working on most recently. Dave Faulkner from the Hoodoo Gurus, thank you for coming on the Batuta Advocate Radio Show. You've had a bit going on. You can boast 9 top 20 albums.
Is that right?
Okay. Yep. 9 top 20 albums. Host of multi-platinum albums.
Yeah, we've done all that. Been around for a while, something like that happens eventually.
You don't seem to be slowing down, mate.
We have. I mean, it's been 12 years since our last record, so that's kind of slow. But there's a few things going on there. But we're still same on stage. We haven't lost any speed on stage, that's for sure. And I think the record sounds like as fresh as anything we've done, so I think we sound all right.
We introduced you as a rock star, but you were born into a political military family over there in Perth.
I was. My parents were both very active in the Labor Party, and my mother actually worked for she worked in electoral office for a local member, and also she was very active in community and local politics. She ended up becoming the first female councillor for the Belmont Shire in Western Australia. She went into that because she loved reading.
Yep.
And my mother was pretty much self-educated. She came from a fairly poor background in Melbourne during the Depression, and she loved books. And every week she'd go to the library, up to basically to the end of her life, where she'd get like an armful of books and read them every week, mostly detective and thrillers.
Yeah.
She loved that stuff. But
The airport novella.
The sort of Agatha Christie and I don't know what the various authors she went for, because there's a million of them. But, so she got a library built in the district because there wasn't one.
Yeah, right.
And that was her big platform, and they ended up naming it after her. So, yeah, very active.
And can you tell us, I mean, you're one of, and I hate to pigeonhole you, I wouldn't say the Hoodoo Gurus fit any archetype, but a lot of people have come from Perth and formed their band in Sydney. How did that wave happen? What was the immigration route?
Yeah. What was the trip like on the Indian Pacific?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I drove over, I've done that a few times. But back then, there was no internet, and the record companies basically are based in Sydney and Melbourne. That was it, and they wouldn't pay attention to anyone that wasn't passing under their noses in Sydney or Melbourne. So you had to become quite well known and tour those places. Well, I don't know. I'd travelled for a year when I was in my 20s, early 21, and I was over in America and the UK mostly. And I just came back and thought, well, I'm kind of sick of being stuck in Perth where no one, you form a band and you kind of last for about 6 months and then break up because you're kind of worn out your welcome after that time. Finite audience. And also in the case of the music we were playing, writing our own songs, it wasn't very acceptable back then.
Yeah.
Because people thought if the songs were any good, I'd hear them on the radio already.
Yeah,
so they can't be any good.
Just pub.
Because a bit of the old tall poppy or whatever you call it, the cultural cringe. Actually, is what it is.
Yeah.
That's the reason I moved to the East Coast, and I had to choose between Sydney or Melbourne. And my mother's from Melbourne, so I chose Sydney because I have a million relatives, and I thought, well, I'm just leaving one family. I want to kind of strike out my own. I might stay away from family a bit. So I had some uncles, an uncle here, and so forth. But I've got dozens and dozens of cousins everywhere, in Melbourne especially.
So is music always going to be the path you were going to go down? Or
nah.
Were you looking at heading out to Cresswell to go into the Naval Officer School?
No, I was never cut out for the military. My father was in the Navy in the war, but he wasn't a lifetime military office, you know, serving. But he actually was worked for the GPO, the post office.
Yeah, right.
Mail sorter most of his life. He had other jobs on the side. He had several jobs at various points, like at the same time. Worked at the markets because he had a growing family, and that was just the way it was done in those days. But I was actually more of an artist when I was a kid. Everyone thought I was good at painting and drawing, and they thought, well, you can't do that for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of art, forget that. And they kind of coached me, or, you know, guided me towards architecture, my mother in particular.
Mm. This new career we've heard of.
Yeah. Well, it just seemed like you can use your drawing for something useful. Yeah.
They always say that. They said, I suppose back then, aspiring artists became architects. Yeah, nowadays they become advertising guys.
Or script writer or novelists. I've seen a few of them become novelists or script writers. But architecture, I tried it. I've done music all my life and, you know, had bands at high school, and we play all the school socials and stuff like that.
So that was school bands, or were you in the church?
No, it's our own band.
Yeah, right.
Our own band that was just basically, you know, was from kids at school.
Yep.
We were cheap, and we played the songs everyone liked.
Yep.
You know, it was a weird combination of songs. We'd play glam rock and heavy rock and, you know, Beatles songs. All together, we didn't see any disparity between playing Alice Cooper and Susie Quattro and Deep Purple and whatever. You know,
played the Sabbath. Hits. Played the hits.
We just played the songs everyone liked at the time. We didn't, you know, we weren't really schooled on the various genres. But we actually, you know, did all right. We even play other schools, so we kind of got a reputation. Yeah. So, and I played keyboards then. Anyway, I went to architecture. But at the same time, I was playing all this music, and I never went to lectures and couldn't be bothered, and I just failed that dismally. And at the end of that year, I had to sort of look myself in the eye and figure out who the hell I was, and that was obviously a musician. So I went and got a job so I could buy some equipment, because I'm a keyboard player and they're kind of hefty and pricey.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I just, here I am.
So your first band that kind of, I guess the first one that got a bit of noise over in WA was The Victims.
Well, certainly the one that people have heard about. I mean, I was in other bands as well that kind of were popular in WA at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I joined a band called the Beagle Boys first. They're a blues group. That was kind of the underground scene in those days. I mean, it still probably is, you know, that sort of blues and roots scene. WA is quite famous for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, John Butler, I think, has sort of tapped into that.
Yeah.
But I was in this group. They were going before I joined, and I just came in and right towards the end. And, yeah, they lasted about another 6 months. But the funny thing is, I was already obsessed with punk rock when I joined the band.
Yeah.
And this was like 1976, and I basically was trying to teach myself guitar so I could go and form my own punk rock group, which happened, as you say, formed the Victims in mid-77.
And what was the influence there? What was the – I mean, punk rock is something that was happening at that time, but what were you seeing? I mean –
well, in Perth, nothing. You know,
yeah,
like,
that's it.
We felt like we were completely isolated and marooned from the culture we were identifying with. You know, we went to the – record shops that sold the overseas music magazines, Melody Maker, NME, Sounds, and, you know, like Rock Scene and people and other magazines from the US. And then, you know, we'd read about these artists. In fact, we read about the Ramones before we ever heard them.
Yep.
And it just sounded so exciting what they were doing. We were desperate to hear it, and we could only imagine what this music sounded like from the descriptions. Eventually we got the album, the Ramones album, and it blew our minds. Yep. I mean, it wasn't quite what I expected, actually, because it was so poppy, which surprised me. I was expecting what I guess – when I heard the Sex Pistols, that was more what I expected, you know, kind of angry music. And the Ramones had aggro, but it was really different, you know. Mm. And they're still my favourite band from that era. And, you know, I think they're one of the classic bands of all time. So, yeah, I just loved that. And we were in Perth, and we felt kind of like a little bit aggrieved. You know, angry teenagers anyway.
Yeah, and isolated. That's
isolated.
Thing.
Well, Perth is, you know, I mean, Australia is isolated from the rest of the world. Well, Perth is that times, you know, squared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the desert is a huge barrier to anything happening. And, you know, bands would come to play in Australia and they wouldn't cross the desert to Nullarbor Plain to Perth. And that was another source of aggravation for me. I remember one day there was a concert was going to be advertised. Iggy Pop was coming on tour. This is about probably like 1978, early 78. And it was the Pope of Punk. And there was this big, he was playing at the Entertainment Centre in Perth. And it was kind of like, wow, this is incredible. Iggy Pop in Perth. So I queued up hours before the box office opened. And there's already lots of people there, huge crowds. I thought, man, oh man, this Iggy Pop is suddenly quite popular, and got to the box office, and eventually after they opened up and got to, and I thought, well, what seat do I get? And I got middle of the front row. I thought, this is kind of strange. And then later on I found out, of course, all these people were buying tickets for ELO.
Oh, right.
Which was also on sale the same day. So, and Iggy Pop, unfortunately, never made it. He probably only sold about 10 tickets in Perth. Right. At that time, I mean, obviously, now he'd be fine.
Just lop that one off the end of the tour.
Yeah, so we were stuck in Perth, and we just thought, you know, this music we love and you know, everything we were reading about just seemed so exotic, and we felt like, you know, everyone around us was completely oblivious and didn't care about things that we cared about.
Was there political... I mean, I know the isolation thing was a big one. I know Brisbane's punk rock scene. Yep. That was a big thing they even talk about. You don't really look at Brisbane like that anymore. But back then, under Joe, they were isolated.
Oh, and also it was quite a heavy police presence police state, against the punks in Brisbane. We weren't as bothered by police in WA, in Perth. I mean, they didn't like us, but they weren't particularly focusing on us.
Yeah.
We had more trouble from skinheads.
Yeah.
Okay. And other people, but skinheads were the biggest ones that wanted to bash us up.
Yeah.
So how does it make you feel now knowing that the Perth music scene now is really at the forefront of the Australian popular music scene? I mean, you've got some of the biggest acts in the world coming from Perth.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Tame Impala is the biggest one, of course. Yeah. I think it's fantastic. I mean, I love WA and my fellow musicians, even that back then, you know, that produced people like Dave McComb and Kim Salmon. You know, these are great artists and really have contributed a lot to music. So I never was in doubt of the talent pool.
Yeah.
And nowadays, of course, there's no necessity to go anywhere to make your name. You can do it from your bedroom if you're good enough, or if you have maybe a bit of luck as well to get yourself noticed and put on blogs or whatever and come to attention. But the internet is the great, you know...
Yeah. Yeah, Kevin Parker.
Forget having to buy, you know, save up to buy a flight to London, you know, and land there with the suitcase and hopes, you know. That's gone, that era.
Kevin Parker can still be number one ticket holder at Frio and make albums that are going all around the world.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah, man. Yeah. But it's great, you know, and there's other bands like that too. Methyl Ethyl's another one like that. But, yeah, it's different times, and I'm really glad that that's true, you know, because, I mean, we talked a lot of shit on Perth when we were young, you know, and I mean, it's changed anyway, but also that's just kind of the age we were at and just being, you know, hot under the collar and thinking that we were cooler than everyone else.
Big city kids.
Yeah, and just snotty, you know. But, you know, Perth's actually a pretty damn good place, and I think Western Australia is the best state. There's no doubt in my mind about that. So,
Controversial comments, but that's not controversial at all.
I mean, all Australia has something fabulous about it. Every state, you know, even South Australia, which is kind of like, you know, I mean, besides all the wine, there's, you know, a lot of barrenness like WA. But West Australia has the tropics and the Margaret River. I mean, it's just incredible. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about that.
It's vast and it's a vast landscape. And you can hear that. You can hear the different, I mean, as you said before, the blues and roots thing, that very much, I would say, related to the lifestyle that people are living.
Well, there's a little bit of a lotus eating thing going on in WA, always has been, you know, Perth, because life is pretty good there.
Yeah. Well, would you trade the Sharkies for the Western Reds?
I never did, so no. I did sort of meet up with Julian O'Neill when he was over there. It was a very funny story. I don't know if I should tell it, but anyway. He's a nice bloke, he obviously had a bit of a problem at the time, so I don't want to go into that.
Well, when WA decided to launch themselves into rugby league, they did attract a lot of the bad boys of the game over there in the Western Reds.
Yeah, they really were the cattle and dragons of the Super League, weren't they?
So you go from the Victims to the Mannequins.
Yeah, yeah. And then I had one band in between that was called the Midget and the Farrellys. They were kind of this, again, it was like a repudiation of the Victims almost. I was doing something so anti-punk because I kind of got, I was sick of the whole regimentation of punk and the kind of orthodoxy of it.
Yeah.
So I did the opposite. I did this cabaret band and somehow made a lot of money quite quickly, and that's what funded my trip to overseas.
Okay. Overseas first.
Cabaret.
Yeah, cabaret. But we call it cabaret, but it was basically like weird covers from the early 60s, which at that time no one was doing.
Yeah.
And we did it for like zero cost. We carried our own gear. We had like a little column PA. There was no roadies, no hiring of fancy PAs. Just we could set up in the corner of a carpet in a pub somewhere and play, but somehow got very popular very quickly. And we made a lot of money. And after 3 months, I bought a ticket overseas and left 3 months later. So
was that a research trip, or you were going over there to stay? Or
I was just going away because it was like, you know, you're 21, you want to see the world. I'd already been talking the talk for a long time about get the hell out of Perth and see the world. You know, we feel stuck here. And that's what I did. You know, I mean, a lot of Australians did it, not just music fans.
Yeah, for sure. The London push, mate.
That's it. But I went to New York mainly.
All right.
So cabaret music was essentially, you know, the first kind of like the mining boom in WA. Like that's, you know, that's where the kids go and make their money and then they leave. You know?
It was a bit like that. I was a FIFO. I flew out. I didn't fly in. But there was a lot of, you know, successful bands in Perth that weren't, but they all played covers, you know, and they'd usually find a genre or something. And the Farrellys wasn't really like that, but it sort of ended up being like that. But that was the mainstream of music in Perth. And the bands like that I was in, like the Victims and other bands that came in the wake of the Victims, because we were the first real wave of, you know, bands that wrote their own songs at that time. And there had been, back in the 60s, some bands that had written songs. And Bakery was one, I think, in the late 60s, Sid Rumpo. But, you know, it had been a big void for a long time because there just wasn't an industry to support it. And as I say, the attitude also was that, you know, if it's a new song, it can't be any good because, you know, I'd have heard it already.
So you said before that you went to New York. What was it like going there for the first time, you know, as a kid from Perth?
It was weird. I was in Times Square and I had this very strange experience where I felt like I'd been there before. And I hadn't had that anywhere else, but I literally felt I'd been there before, you know, past life or something. But either way, I felt really comfortable there and it was a great time to be there. It was 1979. This was, you know, post-punk, but it was still incredibly, you know, fertile time. I saw the Cramps for the first time. They were a band that were just, you know, had been around for a couple of years, but were just starting to get a bit more acclaim or whatever, a bit more noticed. B-52s, their first album was coming out then. I saw Talking Heads doing a secret show for their third album. And like, it was a very, you know, very early time. And also all the bands you'd never heard of that were popping it up and playing. And, and I also started seeing vintage acts that I'd never heard of before, I mean, or hadn't seen. I mean, I saw Jerry Lee Lewis in a club performing, you know, John Cale. I mean, I'd heard of these people, obviously, but, you know, the chance to see them in a small venue like that was incredible. And it was really a study tour is how it felt to me, finishing school.
Yeah, right.
But it really opened up my eyes. I mean, I'd already wanted to, as I say, expand my taste after punk, because punk was kind of like a little bit like year zero in musical terms. It kind of like purified everything down to its essence.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was like, well, yeah, that's great, but that's given me a kind of like an anvil to strike things against, but I actually want to find more things out there to kind of work with. And I was broadening my taste. I discovered country music. I mean, I'd heard of country music, obviously, but I hadn't liked it.
Yeah.
So, you know, fell in love with country music via Elvis, actually, the Sun Sessions. And, you know, I was also deeply researching into 60s punk, garage, you know, bands from the mid-60s that were influenced by the Yardbirds and the Stones, you know, these one-hit wonders.
Yeah.
And things like that. So it was kind of like a real growth phase for me. And it also gave me I came back and formed the Hoodoo Gurus, like, well, it took a little while because I ended up coming back and joining the Mannequins for a little while in Perth because my tail between my legs, or broke, really.
Yeah.
Just came back and had to pay my parents back for the return ticket. And, and eventually I moved to Sydney and started the Gurus a few months later. But
it was first known as this funny band with three guitars and no bass.
That's right.
It was known as Le Hoodoo Gurus. Who were these fellas? Where'd you meet them? And how'd you come up with that?
Well, Rod was someone from the punk scene in Perth. He'd been in the Sinus at one point. And the punk scene in Perth was very small. So we all knew each other and loved, you know, and fans of each other's bands. So Rod independently moved over with his girlfriend, Erica, and we were all sharing a house. And
where were you living?
Palmer Lane in Darlinghurst.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Back when it was a red light district, that area.
Yeah, nice, good area.
It was a great area. It was fantastic. And Kimball was actually someone I knew through another girl from the punk scene, a good friend of mine at the time. We actually have fallen out subsequently, sadly. Her name was Eva, and her boyfriend was Kimball, who was in the Exile Caprice. He had just left that band a little while ago at the time, or was just leaving them. I don't know how it worked out. But we just happened to be at a New Year's Eve party a few months after I got to town and just talking about music and, you know, all the different things we liked and how there were other bands we'd seen that none of them were doing the sort of influences that we were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just thought, let's form a group. And that was as easy as that, a conversation over a bottle, long neck of beer.
Yeah. All right, the ball's rolling there. You kind of...
Well, eventually.
Eventually.
It took us 9 months to play a gig.
Yeah.
James joined a few months later. We were working and James, the Sinus somehow, they broke up in Perth. Kim, for some reason, wanted to break the band up. And so James wrote a letter saying, look, I hear you're forming a group and I'm a drummer. I want to move to Sydney or Melbourne. So how about I become your drummer? And so that's what happened. And he came over and we only could rehearse on weekends because we all had day jobs to pay the enormous rents you know, in Sydney.
What kind of day jobs did you have then? I mean, like...
Well, James used to work in, like, kitchen hand stuff.
Yeah.
Rod, I'm not sure what Rod was doing. I forget the things. He had lots of different weird jobs. My job, though, I had a job at a place called Hospital Products, and it was a bit of a scam company. They did this product called Surgical Staples.
Yep.
Which are like cassettes that hold little staples that they can zip you up on the inside, and basically has a little concealed blade that will slice open an organ and then stitch it up with the staples and join it together again. It's a bit it's technology that's still used.
Oh right.
You know, when you hear people stapling their stomachs.
Yeah.
That's right. That same company. Yeah. But this the way they started was actually the person who began the company had worked for that. A parent company, or not a parent company, but the same technology in America.
Yeah.
And they'd researched the patents and found out that the one country they hadn't registered the patents for this technology was Australia. So he came to Australia, stole the technology, and started a rival company in the hopes that they'd buy him out. And I think that's eventually what happened. But I was working there at this sort of startup, basically, and it was a clean room. So I looked a bit like Homer Simpson with the full top to toe hazmat thing on. It was basically just dust free. So we work on this sort of NASA sort of filtered technology and, you know, all this sort of stuff.
After a hard day in that environment, I can imagine you want to go back down to Darlo with a long neck of piss and start playing some music.
Or a flagon. You know, flagons were very good in those days. There's before even the cask one was, you know, very popular.
Oh, yeah, the bigger. Yeah, what do they call them now? Growlers, a big jar of it.
Well, you can get a flagon for like $2, you know, up at the Oxford Hotel there, up on Taylor Square. Go to the Tin Hong next door and get those giant spring rolls, two of those for about $2. So you had a meal and a night's entertainment in the case of a flagon, and you know, and talking shit and writing songs.
When did you start hearing about people who had heard about you from people you didn't know? You know, when did you start hearing that your name was getting around?
Ah, gee, that's a hard one. We were playing the Maroubra Seals, headlining there, and it was all the surfers loved us, and there's just this heaving mass of people, and my friend went there and she came in the room. She said the smell overwhelmingly was feminine. May I say that?
Yeah.
And she said it was just hit her like a wave.
Yeah.
You know, we were so hot.
Yeah.
But that's the audience experience. For us up on stage, it's just a gig and we've got lights and sound blasting at us, and we're just trying not to make a mistake or look like idiots.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like you're in your own world. It's like a little. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine that when you sort of, you know, say, how can you not notice a crowd and what's going on? But you're so busy, you don't really kind of take it in.
Yeah, right.
And you know, and it grew, you know, slowly. Like we always were a band that converted people through playing live. You know, radio stations used to in those days they would ring up people at random and play them snatches of a song over the telephone and say, what do you think of this one?
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, it was market research. And they would say, you know, 30 seconds, and they'd say, don't like it, or, you know, yes. Well, it got to the point where we'd played so much around Sydney and, you know, elsewhere that when they rang someone, there's a chance that that person might have actually been to one of our gigs and liked us and recognized
us. Put it on.
And they say, like that one. And so that's how we got, you know, acceptable to radio, because we weren't naturally. I mean, when we got signed up, the record industry almost universally thought it was hilarious because we were not playing what was popular. We weren't playing electronic pop music like Human League and Thompson Twins and all that. And we had no prospects as far as they were concerned. So why would anyone bother wasting time on this band? They're playing guitars, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know, so we always kind of had to do our own sort of converting along on the ground because we didn't really get, you know, much help from the industry. I mean, they played us eventually, but we did most of it ourselves.
Do you remember the moment when, you know, you decided that, you know, you didn't have to sell the medical staples anymore? Like, was there a moment when you were like, all right, I'm going to take this tiny boat out of the safe harbour of being a salesman and trying to
I wasn't a salesman. I was actually working
the raging seas
of the lab.
I was a drone.
He was doing the selling.
He was the one. Yeah. But what I was doing, so I actually quit that job, and I had a bit of a run-in with the union. I tried to unionise the place, and that caused it. That was quite a funny experience. I don't know if you want to go into that one, but you know, I went down and met with the AWU, and the place was black banned and all this sort of stuff. Oh, you know, man. I'd been sacked, and they restored my job, and it was all that sort of.
This guy's just trying to pump and dump this business. This guy unionising our workers.
It was a weird situation, but anyway, I quit the job the day before our first gig. I actually had my last day.
Yeah, right.
So that September of 81. Yeah. I just decided that's it, done. And so it was on the dole then, true. You know, I freely admit it. And I've paid my debt to society many times since then. You know, to me it was a little arts career. Well, you know?
Was that Bob Hawke surf team? That's what they-
I can't remember who was even the Prime Minister then, but 81, September 81, whoever that was. Yeah. But yeah, so I did quit. And, you know, we did sort of take a bit of time to kind of get enough income to be able to go off the dole. But as soon as we could, we did, because it was a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You know, you had to write down all these jobs you were supposed to have gone for.
All and, these and interviews.
And it was just too hard to do,
through,
you know. Yeah. It's easier just to you know, make do on the gig money.
Yeah, so you're a live music band at this point, and you're converting people via live music. It sounds like at that time in Sydney, you could do 5 gigs a night. You know, you could bounce. I mean, between Newcastle and Wollongong, there was somewhere to play every night of the week.
Absolutely. That was, yeah, certainly when we got popular, we were... Yeah, playing six nights a week, quite commonly.
And when was the hard living? Because obviously in every story there is a little bit of hard living. Do you reckon that was
That was hard living.
That was hard living?
Yeah, you know,
were you pissing up each gig?
Oh, no, it wasn't like that. You know, I'm sorry I can't give you those sort of war stories that, you know, a lot of people fantasize about.
No, but I'm talking about the exhaustion of it all. Like, you know, you come off a set and you need a few beers to kind of settle down, and then you might even have a second gig.
I had this weird thing after a while, because being the singer, it was a bit different for me, because unfortunately I'm not like a Jimmy Barnes or where I couldn't sort of go up and drink half a bottle of bourbon and then sing, or, you know, even during the show. I found out kind of early, especially when the intensity of doing more gigs happened, that I actually would lose my voice if I didn't just not drink. And I actually ended up not drinking at all when I was singing, which was kind of weird, because it made me kind of an angry man as well.
Yeah.
You know, on tour, you know, I get a bit, you know,
frustrated. Kind of,
just being like,
can you get rid of this bloke here, please?
No, yeah, but, you know, the other guys in the band, you know, they could drink, you know, much more, and sometimes, unfortunately, some drank too much, and, you know, that was led to problems of its own. But, it wasn't like that, you know, but, the hard living to me was, you know, basically
spending my life
being a working musician and having to kind of toe the line to do that. Yeah, it wasn't really that social. For example, you know, in the late 80s, we would tour to America, and we'd go to America, the US, the UK, and then back to the America for a couple of albums in a row, where we were basically gone 6 months at a time. And, you know, you come home and you talk to people and, you know, your friends and nearest and dearest, and you say, you know, what's been happening? And they say, oh, not much. And they're right. You know, they haven't, you know, the dog hasn't died maybe or whatever, but, you know, you've missed out on those small little daily connections that that are, you know, all about being close and involved in each other's lives, and you have to kind of pick up and reacquaint yourself, and it's a very disconnected feeling, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was actually kind of unhappy in my 30s for that reason, because, you know, I didn't really feel connected.
Yep.
And it wasn't until I literally turned 40. I remember vividly, the day I turned 40, I suddenly felt like a weight lift off of my shoulders. I was like, thank God that's over.
Was that what you're thinking? You're thinking now we can kind of scale down a little bit? Or?
No, not that. I mean, the band had actually at that point had announced it was breaking up, but that wasn't the reason. It was literally because I just found that personally, nothing to do with the band, but I mean, obviously it was related to the band, but just my 30s, I didn't really feel very much satisfaction in that. I just felt like I'd kind of sacrificed my life for my career.
Yeah.
And all work and no play, so to speak, you know? Also, the other thing it was about was turning 40, I suddenly realized, like, you know what? Who gives a rat's what anyone thinks?
Now you can just relish in being a middle-aged man.
I mean, thinking back now, I go, God, is that middle-aged? Because, I mean, I know what it feels like now to be now, and that feels looks pretty young to me now.
Yeah.
But when you turn 40, I've got to tell everyone, if you're worried about it, if you're still younger than 40, don't worry, because your body still looks after you pretty well for the next 10 years. You've got 40 to 50 as a free decade. Unless you're unlucky. So most people feel just as good. You don't sort of creak as much getting in and out of cars as you hear old people doing, you know, making those sounds. We all end up making those sounds, getting in and out of cars or whatever.
Providing you behave as well as Dave Brockenbeard, I'm sure.
Whatever. But the good part about turning 40 is you cease caring so much about what people think of you, and you kind of go, you know what? I'm just me, so I'll just do what I do. And it's such a relief after, you know, spending years basically trying to look, you know, fulfill others' expectations.
What are you kind of saying there, even in this like conversation we're having, not necessarily about the band, but it is quite a relatable conversation we're having right now, that a lot, you know, you're talking to a bunch of people who, you know, there will be a lot of listeners who are about to turn 40 who might exhale.
Lots of listeners on tractors that have to climb in and out.
But the band actually is known for that as well, as being kind of...
old.
No.
Because we are known for that now.
Well, you read about it everywhere. It's the Australians know the Hoota Gurus, they're guys.
We're very proud of that. Yeah. We've always wanted to be, you know, seen as normal people and not, you know, jumped up pop stars. We deliberately made videos that kind of poked fun at ourselves and, you know, punctured the pomposity of being a pop star. You know, all our videos was to our detriment, really, because people, you know, a lot of people didn't take us seriously, you know, for that reason. They thought we were just a joke or you know, just lightweight. Mm-hmm. But the songs themselves were about serious things. I mean, even though they might have, you know, incredibly catchy melodies or whatever, or, you know, be really powerful rock, you know, dancing songs, but underneath it all, they had serious points to make. So, you know, we meant what we were doing. We weren't just being cut, you know, just lightweight in that respect. Mm. But as far as, you know, like having airs and graces, we never wanted to do that.
Yep.
And I think people understood that, the way we carried ourselves and what we've, and the way we always, our music's about that too. It's about being, not mystifying people, just if we've got something to say, we hope you understand what we're saying rather than trying to pretend we're being more in itself important than that.
Yeah. You said at the start, 12 years since your last record?
Yeah, it was a long time.
So it sounds like, reading up on everything that you guys have kind of putting out with this new record, it sounds like COVID, the pandemic might have triggered something in you all.
No, it didn't actually. It was actually in spite of COVID. We started the first recording, the first single came out in December of 2019. So we'd just begun making moves to start recording the album. We were going to do it as a series of singles was our plan. It was a kind of like a different approach, pretty much like when we first started. That's how we recorded the first album. So we got that single done and we were just rehearsing the next few songs, thinking this, pick a single from these, and we'd written a song called Get Out of Dodge and Carry On, which had both become singles subsequently. But we had studio time booked. We had to cancel it because suddenly in March everything went to lockdown and we didn't see each other for 3 months at all, you know, because we... stuck in our houses, no one was allowed to visit each other, and eventually we got to the point where we could trust each other, and we went and we found the studio people we trusted as well, and we got into the studio and did it, and of course things got better, then they went bad again, and it's been up and down, but the songs weren't written about COVID, they're written more about things that have been going on generally in my life, in the case of the songs that I've written. Brad's written a couple of great songs on there as well, so no, I don't actually think it's a COVID album, funnily enough.
Do you think there was a creative flair spiked by the fact that you needed to get the hell out of the house and in the studio?
Well, we actually set aside 2020 to be a year we're going to make the record.
Yep.
We'd already planned that. So we kind of planned on not doing much live work at that time, but we didn't plan on doing none, which is what happened. And then, you know, we didn't plan on not doing work last year either. You know, that was going to be our 40th anniversary. We kind of had a bit of a, you know, idea to do this tour, which in fact we're about to start. Which is, you know, this tour with the Andy Warhols.
Yeah.
That was a big plan. Obviously, it was a long time in the planning, and that got delayed from last year to this year now. So, yeah, it was great, though, in sense of COVID, because it gave us something to focus on creatively. We were stuck in our houses, but, you know, I was really busy writing songs, working, you know, and then we were in the studio up and down and mixing them all. It just was, we always had something to do, plus there were videos to make and singles that were being released. So there was always something going on. So kept me sane in that regard.
Has the creative process changed over the years? Obviously, since you were, you know, paying rent on Palmer Lane to, you know, now obviously you can live in a place where your car's not going to end up upside down on fire in Camperdown Park, you know.
Unless the drains flood.
Yeah, but has the process that you've all gone through to make these classic albums over the years, has that changed much over the time?
Not for me. I mean, I think I'm better at writing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, only people can answer that, you know, that listen, because they're the ones that ultimately decide. But I feel like I, you know, as a writer, I come up with less duds, songs that I do go, you know, that's just not happening. A song may not be one we record, but it's mainly for the reason that, oh, it sounds like the sort of thing we would do. So we choose not to do that, to repeat ourselves too much. but the song itself's not like a bad song. It's actually a pretty good song. As far as writing, I've always been the same. I'm a very lazy person, believe it or not, even though I work really hard when I'm working. I'm a major procrastinator, so I don't have songs that are written waiting for the band to learn them or anything. I basically don't start writing songs till the album's planned. Mm-hmm. What I do is I accumulate little ideas on my phone these days. I used to be on the cassette player or whatever. And, I might be, going for a morning walk and just a guitar riff idea comes in my head or a bit of tune and I'll just sing it into the microphone and they'll forget about it. And when it comes time to record an album and write some songs, I'll go back to these little source tapes and whatever you want to call them, files. And what still inspires me, I'll work on and turn it into a complete song. It might even be a half-finished song, but it doesn't feel that way to me. They're kind of like just bits and bobs. So that's what I've always done, and it's partly why we take so long to make albums, because I always think to myself, I haven't got any songs, how can we make an album?
Because
there's nothing there. The cupboard's empty as far as I can tell. But, of course, there's all this sort of stuff that's been sort of, put aside for
little,
later. And
little morsels.
Yeah, so I've actually got to make myself sit down and have a deadline, and then I work on it and write the song. So all the songs in this new album are brand spanking new, except for one, which I wrote in 2004, I think, 2003, it's a song called Settle Down, which is actually about growing old, so it's funny because it's the youngest song. I mean, it's the song's from way back. But the song's actually brand new, so I'm kind of proud of that, actually.
I mean, there's no better deadline than the 40th anniversary either.
Well,
that'll fire you up.
Yeah, well, just seriously, just book some studio time, have a producer lined up. Funnily enough, you figure out you better do something before you go in there. You don't want to look like an idiot when you walk in the door with nothing. So that's what happens.
And are you ready to rock?
Not this minute, but give me a half an hour. I could probably be ready to rock. I've got to warm my voice up. That's what it is. Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping you're ready to rock, Dave. You know, there's a lot of people expecting to hear you. A lot of people out there waiting to hear you. And, everything's opened back up now. So both your fans and your band can all do what you love doing. And I'll be there. I'll be there in the crowd listening. You've just released Chariots of Gods. It's your 10th studio album. And in true Guru's fashion, 14 bangers. There's actually 17 on the deluxe double vinyl edition. And it's distinctively Hoodoo Gurus that I'm hearing when I listen to it. So thanks for joining us, Dave. And congratulations on everything you've done in your career and over the last couple of years during these difficult times.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks.